Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at the BBC in London today. It's Here and Now, and we will get to the political challenges in the UK in a bit, but first to the breaking political news in Washington.
And Jeremy, it has been a challenging morning here as well. The House this morning approved a resolution to expand the impeachment inquiry and lay down rules for open hearings, with a vote almost entirely along party lines and a bitter exchange of words before that vote. Republicans who'd been pushing for the vote condemned it. Here's Steve Scalise, Minority Whip, speaking beforehand on the House floor.
This is unprecedented. It's not only unprecedented, this is Soviet-style rules. Maybe in the Soviet Union, you do things like this, where only you make the rules, where you reject the ability for the person you're accusing to even be in the room, to question what's going on.
I'm going to take up that charge, but meanwhile, the impeachment inquiry continued elsewhere on Capitol Hill, where yesterday the former top Russia official for the White House announced he'd be stepping down and today stepped into a hearing room to be deposed. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez joins us now. And Franco, you broke that story about Tim Morrison stepping down. We're going to get to that. But the White House issued a statement just after that resolution passed, saying Democrats are choosing every day to waste time on a sham impeachment, blatantly partisan attempt to destroy the president. You know, but the resolution does give the president some rights. So tell us what the resolution does for him and what we can expect from the White House.
I mean, what we can expect from the White House is what we have been getting so far. The president has been very consistent, directing people, you know, to his transcript of the call with the Ukraine president, saying there was nothing wrong. As you pointed out, right after the vote, he came out. He called this the greatest witch hunt in American history. I think we can continue to expect that he's going to cast himself as a victim in what he describes as a political takedown.
Well, we heard Representative Scalise say this was Soviet-style rules. You make them up as you go along, reject the ability of the person you're accusing to be in the room. I mean, is that true?
I mean, these are like specific talking points that the Republicans have been passing around in recent days about a Soviet program. In many ways, this is a standard process. I mean, the fact that the Democrats are doing this, holding a vote, is actually to try to undercut some of that criticism that the process is wrong. This is actually, you know, kind of more regulating the process like it has been done in past impeachment hearings.
Yeah, well, the resolution also lays down rules for open hearings, something else the Republicans have called for. The very same witnesses who have been behind closed doors will be in open hearings. And who will the House want to hear from?
Well, Schiff said in a statement that the American people will hear firsthand from all the people that can describe the president's actions. But he did not indicate specifically which witnesses he would call behind closed doors. Next week, we are going to hear some more people. We expect to hear, or they want at least want to talk to John Eisenberg, the top lawyer at NIC, the top aide to the chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, Rob Taylor, and a bunch of other White House insiders. They also want to speak with John Bolton, the former national security advisor. Eventually, though, once it gets back to open, they would like to hear from William Taylor, who is the top U.S. diplomat to Ukraine.
Who talked about that phone call the president had with the Ukrainian president. And now we have Tim Morrison's deposition today. He's, as you told us, the former top Russia expert on the National Security Council. He left the administration. What role did he play and what might he talk about?
Well, you know, as the senior director for the region, Morrison had, you know, was the person at the NSC who had like the closest relationship with Ukraine. His name was cited more than a dozen times in that testimony that we just referred to from William Taylor. And according to that testimony, Morrison alerted NSC lawyers about demands that the Ukraine government investigate a company with ties to the son of former Vice President Joe Biden. Morrison also conveyed that Trump wanted the Ukraine president to go to a microphone and say he is opening an investigation before the U.S. would release millions in security aid.
Yeah, well, and Morrison, a hawk, just like his former boss, the former National Security Advisor John Bolton, who's also been asked to testify on the Hill. Just briefly, do we know why Morrison would leave?
Morrison, you know, did not, I could not reach Morrison specifically about this. Mm-hmm. His lawyer said that he wanted to testify and was planning to testify as long as he was subpoenaed. We do know that the White House has pressured some aides not to talk, but he certainly said he was going to.
And what about John Bolton, a key figure, also said to be frustrated by what many of these witnesses are saying, at least in their opening statements, was the White House's backdoor efforts, shadow diplomacy in Ukraine. What do Democrats want to hear from him briefly?
They have a lot. They want to hear a lot of things. I mean, it was Bolton that allegedly directed his staffers to call NSC, and he called this pressure campaign a drug deal, according to the past testimony.
Boy, it continues. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, here in London, many lawmakers have left town as they race to campaign ahead of a December election that Parliament ordered up earlier this week. It is a chance for the British people to give their government a bit more direction on Brexit and whether they want it to happen at all. One part of the UK that is very much against Brexit and is trying to stop it is Scotland. Carol Monaghan is a member of Parliament with the Scottish National Party. I sat down with her in her office yesterday before she went back to Scotland to campaign, and I asked her what her party's message to voters is heading into the election.
Our message is very clear. We want to stop Brexit, we want to stop Boris Johnson, and we want to give Scotland the right to choose its own future.
When you say give it the right to choose its own future, are you talking about another referendum that would take Scotland out of the UK?
Well, we've got two issues on the table just now. First of all, Scotland voted to stay in the UK in 2014, but part of that vote was generated by people who were concerned that they might be taken out of Europe if they voted for independence. Now, in 2016, Scotland voted very strongly to remain in Europe, and now we find that we've been taken out of Europe against our will. So there's actually two issues. Do we want an independent Scotland, but do we want to remain in Europe? And Scotland's been pretty clear about where it wants to be in Europe. So at the moment, Scotland is suffering from a democratic deficit, and we need to deal with that.
Do you think that if there were no Brexit, that Scotland would decide to remain in the UK, if the UK remained in the EU, or would Scotland still want to leave the UK?
2014 referendum was a kind of start of a process. And during that referendum, many promises were made to the people of Scotland that were subsequently broken. So I think really we've been seeing a steady shift towards self-determination, towards independence, regardless of the Brexit situation. But I think the Brexit situation has really accelerated this and has confirmed to people in Scotland that actually it doesn't matter what you do, England still decides your destiny.
Well, let's talk about the Brexit side of it. There are a lot of people in this country who voted to leave, and they would say that the will of the people was to leave. Why should they be ignored? What do you say to those people now who have not gotten the Brexit that they asked for?
First of all, it's difficult to know what they actually asked for. There was no manifesto, there was no white paper on what Brexit meant. People were told that there were graphics on the side of a bus, there were messages in newspapers, but there weren't any clear promises or clear guarantees of what Brexit would mean. So people voted for Brexit or voted against Brexit based on what they thought it meant. As we approach the time of leaving the European Union, thankfully that's been postponed for another 3 months, but it becomes clear what that Brexit vote has meant. Now, many people thought they were voting for something and have now found out that they're voting for something quite different. So for those people, they need to know what actually Brexit means. And if Brexit doesn't mean what they voted for, they need to actually have another chance to vote in that way.
Do you think that there's any irony in the fact that you and others in your party are saying that Britain shouldn't leave the EU, but Scotland should leave the UK?
No, it's two very different things. What we're talking about, the EU is basically a group of nations that trade. And in order to trade, you have to follow the rules of the trade agreements. That's pretty straightforward. Now, if you listen to the Tories, they would tell you that that means you lose your sovereignty, that means you lose your decision-making power. That is nonsense. Decisions about immigration are taken here at Westminster. Decisions about foreign policy are taken here at Westminster. If you want to trade, yes, you have to abide by the rules of the trading agreement. That's quite different from not having sovereignty. So what we want in Scotland, we want to be taking the decisions about how we are going to use things like immigration, for example, to spur our economy. But we want to be making the decisions in Scotland that are best for the people of Scotland.
I saw that you're a scientist by training.
I'm a physicist, yes.
A physicist. Does this mess in Parliament feel like a complicated problem that has to be solved in your mind?
I suppose that the thing about being a physicist by profession is, you know, everything is about logic and it's about evidence and it's about making decisions that are based on actual facts. Politics seems to be missing some of that at the moment. So, yeah, it's a mess. And one of the real frustrations for me is hearing non-facts or, frankly, blatant lies been portrayed as though that is actually evidence or truth. It's worrying times.
That is Scottish National Party MP Carol Monaghan. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And what a great accent. And by the way, as Carol Monaghan heads back to Scotland, one of her tasks will be convincing voters to go to the polls, despite the fact that in December, some parts of Scotland have less than 7 hours of daylight. Maybe one reason this country hasn't had an election in December in nearly 100 years.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Today, as part of our continuing conversation with presidential candidates, we welcome Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont, part of a crowded Democratic field. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And let's get right to it. You are now one of two progressives running second and third behind Joe Biden. You and Elizabeth Warren split about 35% to 40% of the vote between you. Presumably one of you would double that if the other backed out. I would ask her, you know, if she were here, you know, Bernie was first. Why not you back out? I'm asking you, Senator. You've had a heart attack. She has momentum. Why not back out and double the chances of your ideas winning?
Well, first of all, we do have a process to determine who the nominee should be. And frankly, I have a great deal of confidence that at the end of the day, because of the ideas that we are fighting for, the momentum that we have, the poll came out the other day that had us in first place in New Hampshire, I think we're going to win this thing.
Well, then tell me this. Why should Democrats vote for you instead of Elizabeth Warren?
Elizabeth Warren is a friend of mine, and I've known her for many, many years. But you ask me why I think people should vote for me, and I'll tell you why. 4 years ago, I ran for president of the United States, and I brought forth a series of ideas, raising the minimum wage to a living wage, the understanding that health care is a human right, not a privilege, through Medicare for All, making public colleges and universities tuition-free, understanding that climate change is the existential threat facing this country and the world. 4 years ago, those ideas were seemed to be radical, but I was out there fighting for the rights of working people and taking on the greed and corruption of the corporate elite. These are not new ideas to me, and that many of the ideas that I introduced that were seemingly radical 4 years ago are now kind of mainstream, adopted by many other candidates. And my job as a candidate is not just to defeat Donald Trump, the most dangerous president in the history of this country, but it is to transform our government and economy so that it works for all of us, not just the 1%.
I was exactly going to say that your ideas 4 years ago seemed wacky, now are mainstream. In fact, let's take Medicare for All. A majority of Americans are now in favor. Warren has been taken to task for not saying how she'd pay for Medicare for All. You've been saying, been acknowledging, it will entail middle-class tax hikes. But I just want to ask you, yesterday, the Biden campaign went after you for not saying how much those hikes would be. You'd said on CNBC you didn't think that you had to be that specific right now. Why not? Why not say how much you think
it might be? Let me respond to my friend Joe Biden. And Joe wants to maintain and continue a wasteful, dysfunctional, and cruel health care system which is costing us twice as much per person as the people of any other country are paying. Canadians are spending, for example, 50% per person of what we're spending. They manage to cover every man, woman, and child in their country. Now, I would ask Joe Biden to tell us, under his plan, how many millions of people will remain uninsured, how many millions of people, or tens of millions of people, will remain underinsured with high premiums and copayments and out-of-pocket expenses. How much will the cost of prescription drugs, which are now the highest in the world, how much will those costs go up? So Biden has a lot to explain to the American people about his plan, which I suppose is consistent with the fact that he has people on his super PAC, which includes representatives of the insurance industry. So Joe has to explain what his plan will cost the American people in ever-increasing premiums and copayments. Now, to answer your question, we have brought forth an outline and several options of how we would pay for our plan. And the truth is that any plan, healthcare plan, will undergo significant debate in the Congress. So I didn't think it was necessary to outline how every nickel would be spent, because it's going to be changed in Congress. But clearly, it'll be funded in a progressive way. And the result is that when you eliminate all premiums, people will not be paying any more premiums, businesses will not be paying any more premiums, no copayments, no deductibles, no out-of-pocket expenses. Yes, and after we eliminate the first $29,000 from taxation, people will be paying more in taxes. But the increased taxes that they will be paying will be significantly less for the overwhelming majority of people than the savings they receive by not paying for premiums and copayments and out-of-pocket expenses.
But, Senator, what about the concerns about the care? You brought up Canada, and you might have seen the recent headline in Forbes. Bernie Sanders was lucky he didn't have his recent heart attack in a single-payer system. This was from Sally Pipe. She's with the Pacific Research Institute. They call themselves a free market think tank. But she said—
Before you go any further, explain to people that a free market research firm is a right-wing corporately funded think tank.
Well,
yes,
that's
your question.
Another way to put it. Well, she cited a study from 1995 from the Journal of the American College of Cardiology that two-thirds of patients in the U.S.
1995 we're talking about, right?
Yes.
That's 20 years ago.
Okay. That two-thirds of patients in the U.S. who needed an urgent coronary angiography, which reveals those blockages in the arteries, got it within 24 hours, you know, here in the States. In Canada, two-thirds of Canadians had to wait more than 3 days just for the test.
Okay, this is, So you're telling me about a right-wing think tank in Canada, but you're not telling me about how do Canadians feel about their healthcare system. Which system is more popular, system in the United States or the system in Canada? Did she write about that?
No, and we happen to know that
did not.
The Canadians are very happy with their system.
Okay, so that's the answer to the question.
Senator, I want to move on to other topics, but just staying with this topic for just a second, and since I mentioned it, how are you, by the way? And what you sound pretty good to me, and what would you say to those who are worried that, you know, you had a heart attack at 78?
Well, first of all, I want to thank people from all over this country for their prayers and their well wishes. It has meant a lot to me and to my family. And I'm feeling excellent right now. We're back on the campaign trail full-time.
Yeah.
And I do appreciate the love and the concern that so many have shown.
Okay. I want to do something of a lightning round, just because there's so much we want to get in. Impeachment. You're a senator. Right now the process is in the House. If they vote to impeach, it goes to the Senate. Last night I happened to hear from some Democrats who wanted me to tell you, don't do this. They say Democrats are making Trump a victim. Republicans are seizing a false narrative about closed-door hearings being unfair. They're not. They're usual. And that if there's no conviction in the Senate, the Republican-controlled Senate, these Democrats are worried that A.G. Barr will do what he did with the Mueller report and make it sound as if there were no findings at all. They are worried that Democrats are on the wrong path with impeachment. Your thoughts?
I think that in many ways the House doesn't really have a choice. When you have a president who I think is guilty of obstruction of justice, who is guilty of violation of the Emoluments Clause because he is enriching himself through the office of president, when it is clear that he used U.S. military aid to Ukraine to try to get dirt on a political opponent. If you ignore that reality, you set a precedent for future presidents to say, I could do anything I want. The Constitution and the impeachment process doesn't mean anything. And whether it's good politics or bad, who knows? But I think they have got to go forward. But I do think that through that entire process, the American people will learn that this president is not only a pathological liar, I don't know that he actually knows the difference between truth and lies, but that his administration is probably the most corrupt administration in the modern history of this country.
Let's say you are elected president. First 100 days, what would you do?
Well, we begin the process of creating an economy and a government that works for all, not just the 1%. And we will tackle the reality that we have more income and wealth inequality in America today than any time since the 1920s. So we will bring forth, working with our friends in Congress, legislation that substantially changes our tax code. We will most certainly introduce legislation that tackles the existential threat of climate change and the need to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel. We will introduce Medicare for All, legislation to make public colleges and universities tuition-free, immigration reform, criminal justice reform. You know, you will find that the U.S. Congress can chew bubble gum and walk at the same time. We can go forward in addressing the real needs of working families and in taking on the greed and corruption of the corporate elite.
And finally, you call yourself a democratic socialist, and that's caused a lot of confusion, as you know. Just very briefly, what does that mean to you?
What it means is picking up on the legacy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who understood that economic rights are human rights, that people are entitled to health care as a human right, that our people are entitled to be able to get all of the education that they need as a human right, which is why we're going to make public colleges and universities tuition-free and cancel student debt.
But does it mean you know, the end of the free market, the end of...
No. Look, what you see all over the world are governments who are standing up for working people, not just unfettered capitalism. So all that I am talking about is creating a nation where you have a government that works for all and not just gives tax breaks to billionaires.
Bernie Sanders, Senator of Vermont, one of many Democrats running for president. Senator Sanders, thanks for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Take care.
One last question. What are you going as today?
I think I'm going to go as Bernie Sanders.
Other people are, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And by the way, he lobbed a charge there at Joe Biden about his new super PAC having insurance company contributors. Question, do you think Democrats are spending too much time in fighting over health care? Your thoughts and our other conversations at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Here they are, one strike away, one out away. 3-2. There it is! The Washington Nationals are world champions for the first time in franchise history.
Pitcher Daniel Hudson there, striking out Michael Brantley of the Houston Astros. Oh, that thud in the glove. Bringing the Washington Nationals, the beloved Nats, their first ever World Series title. They beat the Astros 6-2 last night in Texas, clinching a seven-game series that saw the away team win every time. That hasn't happened before in any postseason seven-game series, let alone the World Series. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thoughts on the game, highlights?
Well, What you just said, and I want listeners to know, it hasn't happened before in any series, not just in baseball, in any sport. We're talking the NBA. We're talking the NHL. So this was a situation where all the fans of a beloved team pay top dollar and hire a sitter and go out to the ballpark and just see their team lose every day. But if you're a Washington fan, at least you go to a watch party and get the Nationals their World Series. The Nationals came in as a wild card team, and Houston came in as by far the top team in the American League. But the Nationals, after a slow start, showed that they have their special combination, which is excellent, fantastic starting pitching, and some, they usually say timely hitting, but the heart of their order, Rendon and Soto, the 20-year-old Juan Soto, just impossible to get out, and that was all the difference.
Well, that's some of the reasoning, because you mentioned the Astros. They won the World Series in 2017. The Nats were just not doing great. They started the season 19-31 record. For those who don't follow baseball, that 31 is the losses. I mean, how they do this?
This is as far back under 500 as a team has that went on to win the World Series, or I should say, you know, 2 months into the season, they were that far under 500. And they did it because they never deviated from the strength of their team. And with Max Scherzer, who got the start last night, which was a fascinating story because he was supposed to start in game six and he had these back spasms and he literally couldn't put a shirt on. Mm-hmm. And they gave him a cortisone shot. Mm-hmm. And after 24 hours, he was loose enough to pitch. So you have Scherzer, you have Strasburg, you have the starting pitcher Corbin, who also saw some time. And that was enough. And we're told that this is an age when everything is about the bullpen. Neither one of these teams had great bullpens. Well, they both had great starting pitching, but the Nats were better.
I want to ask you about that because people are asking why the Astros benched what people thought was that team's best pitcher, Cole.
Yeah, Cole, you know, this is something that will be questioned because Zach Greinke. The Astros had an amazing array of arms, and they went out and they added Greinke as, okay, why not, a surfeit of riches. And 80 pitches into the game, he had given up a walk and a solo home run, but he was, as they say, dealing. And yet, I guess A.J. Hinch, the manager, figured he was spent, or this was probably a case of overmanaging. They pull the great Greinke, and then the reliever comes in and gives up a home run to the aging reserve, Howie Kendrick, who puts the ball off the pole, and then the Nationals never look back. It was a bad managerial decision, to be sure.
Well, we always want to say both teams, you got there. You know, and they can take that away from you. And I just love it. Mike Pesca again here now, sports analyst, the host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Anytime a sports segment can have the word surfeit in it is a good thing. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome.
It's Here and Now.
Every time I come back to England, I visit my grandmother, Margaret Hobson. She is now 93 years old and has lived here all her life. My dad was born and raised here, but obviously the British accent was not passed on to me. Last year, I interviewed my grandmother for the first time, and she told me that she didn't vote in the Brexit referendum, but it was clear that if she had, she'd have voted to leave.
Brexit seems very strange because to us, especially my generation, because we're definitely not Europeans. I mean, we're British and that's it.
A little backstory. My grandmother lived with my late grandfather Richard in Coventry for decades. They were married for 67 years. Coventry is about 100 miles from London in an area where most people voted for Brexit. My grandparents lived there during World War II when Coventry was a factory town making materials for the war effort. And the Nazis singled it out for attack.
Amid the wholesale wreckage of a noble city, crushed by the force of hundreds of tons of bombs, the steeple of her one-time beautiful 14th-century cathedral looks down on a scene of indescribable desolation.
My grandmother lived through that, hiding in the hills nearby as the bombs fell. And the bombed-out shell of that cathedral still stands today, ringing its bells as if it were still whole.
Thank you.
Since my last visit, my grandmother has moved from her house in Coventry to an apartment in a retirement community in nearby Kenilworth. Her living room is laid out basically the same way, with a coffee table perfectly situated to rest a cup of tea, a newspaper folded in half on one side of the table, some family photos up on the walls, and one of my grandfather's paintings of the sea.
So what do you think about the fact that after our interview a year ago, there are lots and lots of Americans who know who you are and they want to know what you think?
I'm very amazed. I am really amazed. But nice. Very nice. Nice to be famous for 5 minutes.
Do you think Brexit will ever actually happen?
No. I don't think so. We're too involved now with Europe. I don't think we could ever really break away now. We're too much involved.
Really? Because a lot of people in this country would like to.
Would like to, yes. I mean, we still think that we're big enough to run everything on our own, but I'm not so sure.
You don't think so?
No, not so sure now. No. I think we need a bit of help from the others now.
How much do you talk about this with people when you have your monthly fish and chips dinner here? Do you talk about Brexit?
We never discussed at all. No, I'm afraid we're not very, very good at that sort of thing. I mean, now you'd really have to ask the younger generation, because they're the ones that are doing the voting and are choosing. I mean, we've sort of had our day and our time with it. So I think you'd really have to find out from somebody a lot younger how they feel about it.
On the British side of my family, there are actually three younger generations living in the UK, most of them near my grandmother. Her grandnephew, Adam, is 37 and a hardcore Brexiteer. His wife is from Thailand, and Adam says EU rules made it more difficult for her to find work as a pharmacist when she first came to the UK. So he wants the UK to crash out of the EU without a deal.
Yes, I would be very happy if we just left without a deal.
Why?
When we had the original question put to us about whether we wanted to leave the EU or not, it was to leave without a deal. And it seems that going on and going on, the opposition to the parties have always been saying, no, we don't want to leave without a deal. We need to have something. We still need to continue that relationship. And I'd be much happier if we just totally left and negotiated a brand new deal, a brand new agreement. We've got to do it with the rest of the world anyway, so why not do it with each individual company in Europe?
Well, the people arguing against a no-deal Brexit would say that there's going to be chaos, that there will be unforeseen circumstances, that there will be food and medicine shortages, et cetera, et cetera. You're not worried about any of that?
Well, I didn't vote for them, and to be honest, I think that they're scaremongering as well. They've said a lot of things going forward, that when we said we'd leave, if we chose that, our economy would suffer, there'd be these problems, there'd be that problems. And there's not been the evidence of that at all. It just hasn't happened.
That position puts Adam even beyond Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who famously said he'd rather be dead in a ditch than extend today's Brexit deadline. He said he'd leave today with or without a deal, but eventually did extend the deadline in a bid to get his Brexit deal with the EU through and avoid a crash out. Meanwhile, all this talk of Brexit is making us hungry. So we gathered two other generations of the family, Adam's parents, and his 15-year-old daughter, and made our way to an English pub called the Queen and Castle. After a pint of beer served at room temperature, which I must admit does taste better than the colder serving you get in the U.S., and some roast chicken served with seasonal greens and Yorkshire pudding, I asked Adam's father, David, how he voted in the 2016 Brexit referendum.
The same as most of my family, I guess, Brexit.
Why?
Because I just didn't fancy the idea of a federal Europe, because I couldn't see that working in the same way as it might work in the States. It couldn't do it here in Europe.
And you thought that's where they were headed?
Absolutely, and still heading. So, yeah, that's the fundamental reason. And basically, I think Great Britain can do a lot better outside the constraints of a very protectionist market.
So do you think that Brexit will actually happen?
It will ultimately. At least that's my belief and hope.
And would you be okay with it happening with no deal?
No deal simply means a little bit more chaos up front, but ultimately it'll end up in basically a free trade arrangement throughout the world with our control over our own destiny.
David's wife, Petta, who is my father's first cousin, sees things pretty much the same way.
I want them to just get on and get it done and do what the vote from the people said we should do.
And Brexit?
Oh, yes, definitely Brexit.
You voted to Brexit?
I voted to Brexit.
Why?
Because I felt we needed more control over what we did in this country. That sometimes things were overturned in Europe for what we actually stood for ourselves here in this country. And I just felt it was going to be a better option for us.
So do you think it will actually happen?
Yes, I think it will happen. If it doesn't happen, I think there could be a period of almost civil war in this country.
There is one more generation of the family sitting at the table. Adam's 15-year-old daughter, Charlie, is not old enough for a pint of beer, but she is old enough to understand Brexit and to be diplomatic in her comments about it.
It's one of those confusing things that they constantly make us try to debate at school. So we have the whole sort of the two points of the argument. We've got the first point, which is if we leave, there's a lot of children that won't have the freedom of movement across the European Union. And obviously loads of children are like, well, that's taken away loads of opportunities we could possibly have. But equally, if we do leave, there's loads more opportunities that can be opened up for more of the children. And so it's this weird sort of double-edged blade that a lot of people just don't really know what to deal with.
Well, what do you think?
I don't really know. Like, I think the idea of leaving seems like sort of the better option. But I think that's just because, like, I sort of understand it from my family's point of view.
What do you want to happen now? Because there's a lot of uncertainty about what will happen.
I kind of just want them to sort themselves out and not put us in a position that makes us incredibly weak in the global market. Because that would cause a lot of issues, particularly as I'm getting to the point now where I've got to find jobs and start figuring out what I'm going to do with my life. But yeah, just don't want them to mess up the country.
Full disclosure, we spent most of our afternoon and evening together talking about other things. Life, family, food, travel, maybe a little U.S. politics. David, who wants the U.K. to leave the EU, also thinks it's crazy that Americans are so scared of socialism. A reminder that the politics of Brexit are different than left versus right, which is why no one really knows what will happen when British voters have their say in December. You can see a photo of me with my grandmother at hereandnow.org.
A new wildfire has broken out in Southern California in San Bernardino, where officials ordered evacuations in the middle of the night as that brush fire quickly grew to engulf hundreds of acres. The massive Kincaid Fire in Northern California is up to 60% contained, but that fire has been burning for more than a week and has damaged or destroyed more than 300 structures. As we continue to follow these wildfires, we want to take a minute to ask about the future of the company that could be on the hook for the Kincaid Fire, California's biggest utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E. California Governor Gavin Newsom wants Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway to make a bid for the company, which filed for bankruptcy earlier this year. And the city of San Jose has proposed a public takeover of its lower local power system from PG&E. But what would that look like? And would it bring relief to Californians anxious about a future where wildfires are predicted to get even more severe? Severin Bornstein is professor at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, director of the Energy Institute at Haas. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
So let's start with San Jose. The mayor there wants to make PG&E a nonprofit, customer-owned utility. This model is out there, you know, publicly owned utilities as well as co-ops. But PG&E would be the country's largest customer-owned utility if this happens. Do you think this would work? And how would it work?
Well, I think the first thing we have to recognize is that this isn't going to change anything over the next year or two. California is facing severe wildfire risk, And we have a system that has not been maintained well enough. So when these heavy winds come in, they're starting fires, and none of that is addressed by the potential sale of PG&E or reforming it into any other type of utility.
Well, and you mentioned these big winds. A lot of these big winds blow branches onto wires, PG&E utility wires that are above ground, and they spark fires in that way. And there's some anger, we understand, because, you know, utilities in California have been told for years to put those wires underground. So when you say it's not going to be changed immediately, well, you know, unless all the wires go underground or these areas are better maintained, you know, the brush is cut back and the trees trimmed by the utility companies, things are going to be pretty much the same. Is that what you're saying?
Well, utilities, there has been some discussion of undergrounding, but it would be massively expensive.
Right.
But there are many other things they could do to reduce the risk of wildfire. Better vegetation management around the line, so there are fewer trees that can blow into the lines. Hardening the grid. One of the major fires started when a tower just collapsed in the wind. And better monitoring, so that there are technologies that as soon as a line breaks and the power is no longer flowing, it automatically shuts the power off even before the line hits the ground. Mm-hmm. So all of those can be used, as well as just better visual monitoring for wildfires, to reduce the risk of these sorts of wildfires, and particularly to reduce their growing into massive destructive wildfires.
So back to these plans, you know, the mayor of San Jose wanting to make it a nonprofit, customer-owned company, you know, will that change any of these major problems you've described?
I don't think it will necessarily change it. We do have a problem at PG&E, and we need better management that's more focused on safety. That may come through a for-profit. It may come through a nonprofit. Neither is a magic bullet. It's easy to come up with examples of utilities that are nonprofits and have done a very bad job. For instance, PREPA, the Puerto Rican utility that really was a disaster after the hurricane, is a publicly owned utility.
Yeah.
And there are also some pretty good investor-owned utilities. So I don't think either is an ideal model. It's a question of who the management is and what the culture of the company is. One of the issues that's come up is originally San Francisco and San Jose both proposed cutting off their part of the system and just making that into a public utility. And the problem with that is there are large parts of PG&E territory, like Paradise that burned, that are being subsidized by the more urban areas. And nobody's going to want to be the public utility or the investor-owned utility for those rural areas if they're standalone.
Well, but that raises other questions. People who want a public takeover point out that as a nonprofit, PG&E wouldn't have to pay federal taxes or these shareholder dividends, and that would mean it would devote more money to these infrastructure upgrades. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, it's a possibility, but there are lots of for-profit companies that do in this business who do have a good safety culture. So I don't think it necessarily follows. And even a nonprofit company has a cost of raising capital. They still have to pay interest on their bonds. There are some tax advantages to being nonprofit, but most of our economy is made up of for-profit companies because we think that actually helps the incentives for reducing costs and maintaining reliability. So I don't think it's necessarily going to solve the problem. The real question is, can a government agency, essentially, that's running the grid do a better job than having a private company do it?
That's Severin Bornstein, professor at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, and director of the Energy Institute at Haas. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.